Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Thanks for listening to NPR News today. A House committee began hearings this week on the January 6th insurrection. This hour, we're going to talk about the first accounts the committee heard from Capitol Police officers, the testimony and evidence that will be presented over the course of the hearings, and the prosecutions that are in the works. I'm also interested in the political implications of bringing the full story out to public view. In a new book from Washington Post reporters Carol Lenig and Philip Rucker, Lenig told us Wednesday that as many as 8,000 protesters had breached the Capitol barriers on that day and were, quote, streaming through the halls of Congress. Police of the Capitol, they write, were badly outnumbered by rioters, engaged in hand-to-hand combat, and losing the fight to secure the Capitol. Five people died, more than 150 Capitol and Metro police officers were injured, and two Capitol officers have died by suicide since then. In testimony on Tuesday, the officers spoke about what it's been like to hear former President Trump and Republican politicians diminish the threat of the insurrectionists.
The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
That's Officer Michael Fanone. President Trump watched most of the insurrection unfold on television in the White House and, according to press reports, resisted calls from family and White House aides to tell the rioters to stand down and go home. As our guests join us this morning, what do you want to know about the House investigation? What's happened to the people who were involved in the rioting? And the role of the politicians in aggravating the situation. Have you thought about how history will view this insurrection? So questions about how it actually happened and what the investigation is bringing to light, and then whether you've given some thought to how history will view what happened. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet in at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Our guest this hour, Seamus Hughes, is the deputy director of the program on extremism at George Washington University. With us from D.C. And Professor Hughes, welcome. It's good to have you in the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Paul Waldman is with us, an opinion columnist for the Plumline blog at The Washington Post and senior writer at The American Prospect, and also with us from D.C. And Paul, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the line.
Thank you.
Paul, I wonder if, as closely as you've followed this, and I know you've been writing about the investigation, there are details coming out about how this insurrection unfolded that are new to you.
Well, not really in terms of specific kind of revelations. And I think that is something that it's always possible that we'll get out of this investigation. But we may not. You know, it seems like every time we get some kind of new bit of video, you sort of add to the color, the understanding of exactly how chaotic it was, how violent it was. But I think that it's possible that we may get some information like that out of the investigation. We may learn from some of the prosecutions that are starting and the guilty pleas of the people who have been arrested in terms of the coordination, the planning, what went into that. But I don't know that the public is going to, you know, learn something like something dramatic, like, you know, that we find out that Nixon had a taping system in the White House, anything like that. I think that's yeah. often the expectation that we go into these kinds of these sorts of hearings with. And, you know, often it doesn't pan out. However, I still think it's vitally important because there are a huge number of Americans who don't really understand what happened there. And this was one of the most extraordinary attacks on our democracy that we've ever experienced. And, you know, you have an entire propaganda apparatus out there to convince people that either it wasn't that big a deal or that it was some kind of false flag attack orchestrated by Antifa or by the FBI. That's what Tucker Carlson tells his audience on Fox News. So you have this huge amount of misinformation out there. And hopefully, although we can talk about how much hope one should have, but hopefully
we will.
These kinds of public hearings will sort of let people see this and come to a kind of deeper understanding of what actually happened and what it means and what the kind of the implications are for our politics in a continuing way, because that's a big part of the story too.
Right. Let me take a couple of calls here to Gary in St. Paul. Hi, Gary. Glad you called. What kinds of questions do you have about this?
I actually got two. Okay. I want them to find out exactly what Republicans help these rioters or whatever you call them. I don't call it an erection. I call it a coup.
Okay.
This was done by the President of the United States to take power, to become
so. So, Gary, if I hear you right, which were there Republican members of Congress who were helping the insurrectionists? And I think you said you had a second question.
Yeah, and I just wonder why they don't call this a coup rather than an erection.
Professor Hughes, let me go to the coup question right now. Are we just talking about language semantics here, or is there a difference between an insurrection and a coup?
Yeah, it's really a question of legal issues, right? So they've arrested 550 individuals as it relates to January 6th, and they try to avoid talking about coup or insurrection in the charging documents. They're just going with just the facts, ma'am. So trespassing charges, violence against police, that type of thing. I think that's where the committee can play a role. And Paul's absolutely right. There wasn't necessarily new evidence in the first hearing, but a first hearing should never have really new evidence. I started my career as a congressional investigator doing these type of hearings. The first hearing should be setting the stage, right? And the stage was this was not just a simple protest. It was something greater than that. The second and third hearing, that's where you're going to get to the meat of the issue. Right? Was there information the Bureau didn't share with Capitol Police? Was Capitol Police not properly prepared there? Did DOD not send the National Guard in enough time? That's where you're going to probably get more information.
And Professor Hughes, there's been ongoing questions, I think along the lines that Gary was asking, which is, were there people inside the Capitol, including members of Congress, who either let them in, helped them organize, were coordinating as the group got to the Capitol? Do you have a sense that we will learn that? And then I think we have listeners who are going to ask, and how would those people be held accountable?
So if you look at the individuals charged so far, that hasn't come to light. We've got about 15,000 pages of legal documents on our website. There isn't kind of an indication by the Department of Justice that that's going to be the direction of their investigation. It may be the direction of the committee's investigation, which will probably cause a whole host of issues in terms of the other side of the aisle, but it does raise interesting questions about the role of words and actions, right? Can rhetoric itself inspire violence? And what role and what responsibility do elected officials have in that? And I think that's where a committee type of a congressional investigation like that will get to, and less so, say, a investigation by Department of Justice.
Paul, I want to linger on that question that Seamus raised there about how can rhetoric incite violence, and was the kind of rhetoric that we saw that day, some of the things that President Trump was saying, some of the things that members of Congress were saying to the crowd before they got to the Capitol. There's going to be an eye of the beholder element to that. Do you think that's going to be an important thing to understand and come to some kind of, universal conclusion on? Or is that pretty impossible because of our politics?
Well, we may not be able to come to a universally understood conclusion, but I think it is very important. There's a legal definition of incitement that puts a pretty high bar on what you can be prosecuted for. But then there's a more sort of common layperson's definition that I think is different and where we really can't assign some real blame. I mean, you had, first of all, for lots of time leading up to that event, up to January 6th, you had especially Donald Trump, but other people too, talking about how the election was stolen and how this was a crisis of democracy. If you actually believed what they were saying, then you might think that violence was appropriate. I mean, if you really genuinely thought that a sinister conspiracy had stolen an American presidential election and installed a usurper, then you might think that it would be reasonable to break down the doors of the Capitol to try to stop it from happening. And what we saw in the days leading up to it was that Donald Trump told people to come to Washington on January 6th. He tweeted out that January 6th is the date, come there. And so he instructed them to come. Then he went out and told them that they had to fight, that they were going to lose their country, that they had to walk to the Capitol building. And he kept saying fight, fight, fight over and over, as did Congressman Mo Brooks, who used some even more incendiary language. And then they all went down there. And that's exactly what they did. They believed what he told them. And, you know, you had the same rhetoric being echoed all over conservative media, from really from top to bottom. And we've seen it since then, too. And that's something I think that, you know, when you look out and say, how can people not understand what happened? How can they minimize this? The fact is that if you are a viewer of Fox News or Newsmax or OAN, or you're a listener to conservative talk radio, you have gotten just a torrent of messages saying that either nothing really happened and people just kind of walked in and chatted with the police officers and it was no big deal, or that it was a false flag operation, created by Antifa or the FBI. And if you had tuned in just after that those very dramatic hearings this week, if you tuned into Fox News, what you would have seen is people like Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson mocking the police officers, saying that they were weak because they got emotional about the trauma that they had endured, being beaten and tased and things like that by this mob. You would have seen them, those hosts that you trust, tell you that they were either lying or they were just exaggerating, or that they're people that you should have contempt for. And so all of this rhetoric creates the environment into which this kind of stuff lands. And there are millions of people who will just believe it and think it was no big deal. And then there will also be a small number of people who take it so seriously that they decide that the rational response to this terrible crime that is being committed, just by the fact that Donald Trump is no longer president, that the rational response is in fact violence. And that, I think, is the real danger.
That's a really good context for us to try to understand how this looks if you have been consuming just far right or not even far right, but conservative media. Your perspective is very different. Call here from Beth in Minneapolis. Hi, Beth. Thanks so much for waiting. What are you thinking about?
Hi, Carrie. I really want to thank you guys for taking my call. And this is something that's really been bothering both my husband and myself. What's going to happen with the members of Congress who actually voted to not certify Joe Biden's election? He was constitutionally elected. It is your constitutional duty. You swore to the oath of the Constitution that you were going to uphold it. How can you be a member of Congress and not uphold a valid election that had been certified again, again, and again? This is ridiculous, and those people should be censured and removed.
Seamus Hughes, I think what Beth is speaking to here is it seems that those votes that those members of Congress took is just being seen as, well, more political maneuvering. What do you think of her argument?
Yeah, I understand the argument, but if you look at, I spent 5 years in Congress, and I'm not particularly hopeful about bipartisanship, right? I don't see that happening in Congress in terms of censoring or kicking out members. I mean, if something was to change, there's consequences for those type of things, it's going to have to come through the ballot box.
And you're saying that just because the politics in Congress are so corrosive, so divisive.
Yeah, I mean, listen, they couldn't even agree on a commission for a day of which people stormed the Capitol and injured 150 cops. So if you want to get to a point where you're censoring members, I don't see that happening in any realistic way.
It's a conversation here. Yeah, it's a conversation here that takes note of what Seamus Hughes was just saying, that this is a House investigation because the members of Congress could not get together on a 9/11 style commission. I'm going to talk about that a little later in this conversation, what that means and how the results of the investigation will be seen, because it is not a 9/11 style bipartisan commission. But that's our conversation this morning. What we learned so far in the House hearings that have just begun are we going to fully understand some of the key questions, how the insurrectionists actually breached Capitol security, what they did once they were inside, who helped them, how the political rhetoric from the president and others urged them on, and the political implications of all of this. And looking for your insight on this and your questions. What do you want to know about the investigation? What's happened to the people who were involved in the rioting? And have you thought about how history will view this insurrection? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Seamus Hughes with us, Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University, and Paul Waldman with us, an opinion columnist for the Plumline blog at the Washington Post and senior writer at the American Prospect. Seamus, I want to ask you about something that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in her statement ahead of the committee convening. It read in part, "The violent domestic attack on Congress on January 6 was the worst assault on the Capitol since the War of 1812 and the worst domestic assault on American democracy since the Civil War. Here's the part I really want your view on. We are facing a radically new threat in the kinds of forces that combined to attack our government on January 6th. The future of our democracy is on the line." So, Seamus, I'd like, from your view as somebody who understands extremism, to tell me whether you think that's true. And then, do you think most Americans see it that way? Can you take that on?
Sure. Happy to. It's not a hard question at all. So if you look at the FBI director's testimony a year ago, they said they had 1,000 active investigations in all 50 states as it relates to domestic terrorism. When he testified 3 months ago, it was at 2,500. Right? And so if you look at the domestic extremism landscape, it's all over the map. And in many ways, January 6th was a reflection of that. Think of it like the Island of Misfit Toys. You had militia members, you had Proud Boys, you had QAnon folks, you had everybody in between all coming on to that bug light that was Stop the Steal. Right? And so that's in many ways where the domestic terrorism landscape looks now. It's not just one ideology. It's not just white supremacy. It's not just militias. It's not just QAnon. It's everything all in between. The other thing is it's a salad bar. So you're having people choose their ideologies, a little bit of white supremacy here, a little bit of anti-government there, and so on and so forth. And so it becomes a very fractured threat landscape. In fact, you've seen the FBI moving agents off of international terrorism. So the ISIS and Al-Qaeda cases in the past they used to work on, they're no longer working on. They're getting moved to white supremacy cases. Assistant U.S. attorneys, including some in the Twin Cities, are getting off of ISIS cases and are now prosecuting Boogaloo Boys and militia members. And so you're seeing a complete sea change as it relates to domestic terrorism in this country. The Biden administration announced a new strategy 2 months ago. They're plussing up resources at the FBI and Department of Justice. They've launched a new counterterrorism extremism program. And the way we've done counterterrorism for the last 20 years, looking at international terrorism, is radically different now in the last 6 months because of January 6th.
Wow. And do you believe that most Americans, given all the facts you've just given us, I was unaware of some of that. Do you think most Americans see this clearly, that, as the speaker says, the future of democracy is on the line? Do you believe that's true?
I don't believe that most Americans see that. I mean, Paul was actually exactly right when he touched on it. The committee's investigation is not necessarily for the news for tomorrow. It's not going to change anyone's mind. What it should matter on is the history of the event. So in 5 to 10 years, you have a definitive report of what happened on January 6th, and you hope that kind of rhetoric and people's views kind of temper to the point where they can look at facts and reason. You know, I'm an eternal optimist on these type of things. I am increasingly concerned, on two facts. One is the rise of domestic extremism. And the other thing to look at is our responses to it, because there's something to be said about an over-response to this. If you're looking at 2,500 active investigations in all 50 states, and you're adding in more powers and authorities to look at Americans, that's going to have a whole host of privacy and civil liberties concerns, too, that we have to think through. There's a variety of different factors we have to weigh in. But I would say, listen, the Republic has dealt with issues of this kind maybe not at this magnitude in the past. And we've always kind of taken a deep breath at some point and figured it out. I'm hoping we take a deep breath soon.
I want to listen to something that Liz Cheney said in her opening statement. She is one of two Republicans, I think, on the House Investigation Committee. And I kind of got the sense that this was more for the historical record and less that she thinks this will be persuasive in the moment. But let's listen and then we can ask Paul about that.
If those responsible are not held accountable, and if Congress does not act responsibly, this will remain a cancer on our constitutional republic, undermining the peaceful transfer of power at the heart of our democratic system. We will face the threat of more violence in the months to come and another January 6th every 4 years.
So, Paul, is that objectively true? And then what do you think about the, I guess, the politics of the way the Congresswoman put that?
Well, it's a prediction about the future. I think it's probably right. And Liz Cheney's story, I think, reflects what has happened, and especially to the Republican Party, and how this kind of thing gets validated and encouraged and becomes more likely in the future. You know, she is an extremely conservative Republican, not even just kind of conservative, but extremely conservative. But she is now basically on the verge of being kicked out of the party. She already was removed from her spot in the Republican leadership in the House, simply because she will not go along with the lie that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. And that has become absolutely foundational to Republicans. And there's a particular dynamic going on here. Essentially, there are a few members of Congress on the Republican side who actually believe that Trump won. But most of them are basically just afraid of their own constituents. And this has become, you know, they've long been motivated by that fear. I mean, every politician is, you know, worried about getting challenged, worried about alienating the people who vote for them. But on the Republican side, you know, most your average Republican member of the House, especially, comes from a conservative district where they don't have to worry about being beaten by a Democrat. They have to worry about getting a challenge from the right in their next primary campaign. And so they're always worried about what it is that the right side of the party is thinking. And one of the things that has changed recently is that that has gone from being a fear of being defeated in a primary to an actual physical fear for their lives. And I am not exaggerating. We have had multiple members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, who have said, my Republican colleagues have told me that if I don't, for instance, vote to not certify the election, I am literally afraid that my constituents will kill me and my family. And you've had some Republicans who have said this on the record, that they are afraid that their houses will get bombed, that they know that their own party's base has a wing that is so extreme, so violent, that they're literally afraid for their lives. And so that's really the context. You know, the caller before asked how it was that after the insurrection, just hours later, the majority of Republicans in the House could come back in and vote not to certify the election.
Right.
That's why, because they're afraid. And even if they're just afraid for their next election, they know that this is what their party now believes, that you have to believe that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, that any time a Democrat wins, it is necessarily by definition illegitimate, and that almost any means are justified in order to keep Democrats from ever taking power. And this has become kind of foundational to what Republicans are supposed to believe. And even those members of Congress who don't actually believe it themselves will, at a minimum, give a wink and a nod to it so that they can stay on the right side of their own constituents. And that then only encourages it. And as Liz Cheney said, it's, you know, what is going to happen in the next election if, say, Joe Biden gets reelected? Is there going to be more violence? I think it's almost inevitable. So that's the future we could be facing.
Boy, there's so much to talk about there, but I don't want to miss a call here from John in South Dakota. Hi, John. You've listened to the conversation develop here. What are you thinking about?
I listened to a lot of it, but I guess my question is, it's kind of a, you know, Democrats say one thing, Republicans say another. So this attack was supposedly, allegedly, as your show is saying, by the Republicans. Why aren't we so much concerned about the domestic terrorism that took place, tearing down our national statues, burning police stations, taking mm-hmm. over cities, things like that. I mean, I get that this is an attack on the White House, but it was also
on the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. Attack, yes, on the Capitol, but that also is attack on our nation, and you never hear anything about that, or they're not having a trying to figure out who is behind all that.
Okay. Paul, I want to come back to you on what John, our listener from South Dakota, brought up. You do hear this, how is what happened on January 6th any different from what happened over the summer with demonstrations and protests ignited by the murder of George Floyd here in Minneapolis? Members of Congress are saying it. President Trump is saying it. Tell me how you explain, when you hear that kind of reasoning, the difference.
You know, I think it's something that we could certainly look into, talk about, you know, but the question is it necessary that in order to have an investigation of January 6th, we have to go find something that Republicans are mad about and then also investigate that? It's kind of classic whataboutism. You know, as Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who's one of the two Republicans on the committee, said during the hearings, that, you know, you can say that that was terrible, but it wasn't an attack on the fundamental system of American democracy. It's not that, you know, we see that as a threat to the foundations of our system, because it wasn't. You know, you had something like 97% of the protests that took place in the summer of 2020 were completely peaceful. And yes, there mm-hmm. was some violence at some of them, and people who committed acts of violence should be arrested. But that was not part of some kind of campaign to overthrow the American system of government. And that's what January 6th was. I mean, let's not forget what those people were doing there. That wasn't just sort of a formless expression of anger. They were trying to stop the completion of an American presidential election. That's what they were there for. So that's a much more profound and fundamental threat than some people, you know, throwing rocks through the windows of a Walgreens. If people did that, they should be arrested and charged and prosecuted. But that's a very different thing from something that is that requires a congressional investigation.
And Seamus, just to note this, because John said, well, we never hear anything about what's happening to those people that were involved in violence in some of these demonstrations of last summer. They are being prosecuted. We've got prosecutions going on in the Twin Cities, and there are prosecutions going on around the country, right?
Yes. And I mean, your caller got to through to something. It doesn't have to be an either-or proposition, right? If you want to be intellectually consistent about this and you're worried about extremism, you can be worried about all forms of extremism. And in fact, the White House strategy does say that, and the Office of Director of National Intelligence's assessment of domestic extremism talks a good about anarchist violence or anti-government violence. And so one can be concerned about Molotov cocktails being thrown at a Portland federal courthouse, but one can also be concerned about January 6th and not rack and stack them on the same level, right? And so the question is, and we talked about this before, is the threat landscape is such that it doesn't just bucket into one. Now, clearly there is a rise of far-right extremism, but it's not to – there's still a rise of other forms of extremism at the same time. The question is really going to be the focus of resources for the Biden administration on the threat. And I think Paul is exactly right. You know, when you're talking about a congressional investigation – of this magnitude, it makes sense to focus on January 6th, if only because you want to limit your investigation, right? At some point, you're going to have to look at what rabbit hole you want to jump down. Do you want to look at the mm-hmm. FBI with the new leading up to it? Do you want to look at the role of technology companies in terms of organizing and encouraging conspiracy theories through AI? Do you want to look at Department of Defense? And if every kind of rabbit hole you jump in, you're going to lose time to do the other ones. And so you have to narrowly focus your efforts and your inquiry on that.
Call here from William in Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, William. Thanks so much for waiting. Sounds like you're thinking about the historical part of this. Yeah.
Yeah. To answer the question, how will history remember this? I think that is going to come down to your Even the telling and teaching of history is going to come down to your what side of the spectrum you come down on. Even, for example, even school textbooks with the same title, the same publisher, same cover in Minnesota or, say, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line, they can be different. So, like, in the South, the same chapter on the Civil War might call it the War of Northern Aggression, where that's not how it's thought of, you know, here in the northern states, you know. So I really, unfortunately, think that's, it just all comes down to, you know, what side of the spectrum you're on, how you're going to be, how history is going to see this.
Yeah. Yeah. I really appreciate you thinking through that. Paul, I have to say, when I, you know, as a journalist, we hold the facts up as our highest principle. And when I see members of Congress and others denying the facts, it's just infuriating. And yet I think, but this is really important for the historical record. And I think you spoke to that when you said, this is not so much about today, it's about what we'll understand about it for the decades to come. Would you work through that a little bit again?
Yeah, it's one of those things that makes you really worried about the future. You know, I don't know that there was ever a time in American history where we all agreed on all the facts. But things used to be very different, especially in our media environment. You know, back when Walter Cronkite was called the most trusted man in America, pretty much every American household sat down every evening and watched one of the three nightly news broadcasts. And that's all there were. And so there was kind of a shared body of knowledge, a shared agenda. And there were a lot of things about that word that were not so great. But at the very least, you and your neighbor would have heard the same stories and kind of start from the same place, even if you ended up interpreting them differently, you know, having a different kinds of ideas about what ought to be done. But there was that kind of shared baseline of information. But now we exist in a world where there is no shared baseline, and you can get information that is totally and completely different from what your neighbor gets, and, you know, tune it to whatever you like. And again, I said this before, but I think we cannot overestimate the degree to which all of these events are driven by the completely different informational environment people exist in. And so if you are a listener of conservative radio, or you watch especially, not even, I mean, Fox is bad enough, but especially things like Newsmax and OAN, you are existing in a world where the people who broke down those doors and assaulted those police officers are patriots who had a genuine concern about an election that was genuinely stolen. And when you start from those premises, everything is different about it. So I'm not sure, you know, and the thing is that ends up then leading up to the, you know, the caller mentioned textbooks. That's something that we're supposed to kind of all agree on, right? Well, now we're having these fights about whether or not we can talk about race in schools and how we should talk about it. And all of that is driven from those same kinds of news organizations and the same kind of rhetoric and this sort of, you know, creation of false controversies over things like critical race theory. It's all one big interconnected environment. And so I don't think any of us really knows what it's going to look like. And again, it's not that we didn't have mispropagators. As the caller said, you know, for decades, if you opened up a textbook, especially in the South, but in places in the North too, you would, you know, the lost cause narrative of the Civil War was the one that prevailed, where it was basically an argument over states' rights and noble Southerners were defending their homes. Those textbooks have changed somewhat in recent years, but that kind of thing happened slowly. And so I don't know in 20 years and 30 years what the textbooks that my grandchildren are going to be reading about when they look at the 2020 election on January 6th. I have no idea what they're going to be told, but it's something that I think we're going to keep fighting over for a while.
Seamus, you know, as I listened to Paul talk about that, I thought this is really connected to our conversation on Monday about the myths and the misinformation about the virus and the vaccines. Again, depending on what media environment you swim in, you're getting a lot of good information or misinformation. So here's my question for you. Is former President Trump a symptom of this, an igniter of this, the central problem of this? How would you look at his role in what Paul's just described?
Well, I mean, you look at it like you would for in academia, which is, we call it like an echo chamber, right? If you're only hearing the voices you want to hear, no dissenting voices, no one can challenge you. It doesn't force you to look at the facts as it stands. And I'm not sure where the president would stand in terms of the ecosystem of fire starter or fire flamer, but it clearly plays an outsized role in those echo chambers. But in many ways, you know, these guys would adjust, right? And they will adjust. And if you look at any forms of extremism, if Hillary Clinton had won the election, they would just change the narrative and move on from there too. So I don't want to discount the role of rhetoric from the former president, but we also can't overcount and think that, you know, if something went a different way, it would be a different environment. I just don't think it would be, particularly as the use of social media to both recruit, radicalize, and encourage folks to organize in a way that they hadn't before, say, 5 or even 10 years ago.
Boy, this seems awfully hopeless, Seamus. I mean, it just...
ahead. I am less pessimistic than I think I'm coming out to be. So if you look at January 6th, in many ways, a lot of people are caught flat-footed, right? The FBI was not well-organized in terms of understanding the threat leading up to that. Capitol Police definitely wasn't properly prepared for that level of crowd and violence. And DOD was a bit asleep at the wheel, too. And that's also true of technology companies. They were policing their sites when it came to foreign terrorist organizations, and not so much when it came to domestic terrorism. There's a reason why, and in January 6th, in many ways, a perfect storm, right? Mm-hmm. You had these kind of soccer dads and militia members all coming together in this, you know, cocktail of extremism. But if you look at January 20th, those organizations were only doing that at the state level. They couldn't organize again for a January 6th type of thing. So if you look at the threat landscape, the FBI has a predicate now. Before January 6th, they couldn't knock on the door of a militia member and say, listen, what's up? Why are you saying X, Y, and Z? Now, after January 6th, they have the predicate. If you've talked to an Oathkeeper member who was at January 6th, you can open an investigation of an individual you're concerned about and say, the great example would be California, these two individuals who got arrested for planning to bomb the local DNC. They had no touch point to January 6th other than communication with folks on January 6th, but it allowed the FBI to investigate. And the more you can get to these organizations, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, Three Percenters, that type of thing, those are the folks you should be most concerned about in terms of operational ability and ability to commit the mass casualty events. And so we're probably going to get to a point where the FBI does their thing and knocks down a few of these organizations, and you're going to have these kind of one-off or smaller scale type of things.
Yeah. We've been talking about the historical record. I want to play a couple of the remarks from two Republicans that may end up being pretty important to that historical record. The first is Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger at the commission, at the investigative committee, as it opened earlier this week. The second is Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about, just after the events of January 6th, talking about what happened. So first, Congressman Kinzinger. Second, Senator McConnell. Let's listen.
You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days, how we take accountability for that. And for all the overheated rhetoric surrounding this committee, our mission is very simple. It's to find the truth, and it's to ensure accountability.
The United States and the United States Congress have faced down much greater threats than the unhinged crowd we saw today. We've never been deterred before, and will be not deterred today. They tried to disrupt our democracy. They failed.
Paul, I want to ask you about Senator McConnell's words then, what he said in the days that followed, and if you'll put that into the context of what you said about Republican members of Congress being afraid of their base, having to listen to their base, even when they may know exactly what went on. And there's all evidence that Senator McConnell does. Where do you put him in that?
Well, I mean, Senator McConnell is very focused on really just gaining and keeping power in the Senate. He doesn't really have much of a sort of grand vision for what his party should be in the future. And, you know, he's very secure in his own elections. He just won re-election this past year quite easily. And, you know, in Kentucky, he can win as many times as he wants. But it's a larger question for the Republican Party as a whole. And, you know, I think it gets back to their sort of fundamental theory of their own future. You know, if we think back to 2016, there were a lot of people in the Republican Party who were saying, you know, we need to change something because, and this, I mean, before the 2016 election, the country is changing. You know, we have this base that is almost entirely white, almost entirely Christian, and we need to adapt to the changing demographics of the country, which is getting younger, getting more diverse. And so we need to kind of alter the way we do things. And mm-hmm. that was almost a consensus within the Republican Party about mm-hmm. it. They weren't quite sure how right. to do it, but they knew they needed to broaden their appeal. Then Donald Trump
came
along.
And that was the autopsy after an election, yeah.
Right. Then Donald Trump comes along in 2016, and he says, hell no, that's not what we have to do. We have to double down on the people that we have. We have to be more xenophobic. We have to be angrier. Through a rather extraordinary confluence of circumstances, it actually worked. And he won the Electoral College despite losing the popular vote. And even though he lost in 2020, his theory of the case is still the one that prevails within the Republican Party. That, you know, there are very few people saying that, no, we need to, you know, open ourselves up and become more diverse, look to broaden our appeal. There's almost nobody in the party who has any kind of power who is saying anything other than following anything other than the path that Trump laid out for them, even though he lost in 2020, by quite a considerable margin. And that's one of the strange and unique things about this is ordinarily when a party loses, they don't want to have anything to do with the guy who lost. And this is true of Democrats and Republicans. And they try to come up with something they can tweak, something they can change that will enable them to win next time around. But basically nobody in the Republican Party is saying that right now. They're saying, let's just do the same thing. And even the ones who are not explicitly supporting Donald Trump himself, they all believe that they have to have kind of a Trumpian style and emphasis in order to appeal to the Republican base. And they're probably right. You know, I mean, if you think about the 2024 election, it's impossible to imagine somebody in the mode of John McCain or Mitt Romney or George W. Bush winning the nomination of the Republican Party. You can only imagine somebody who tries to be as much like Trump as possible winning. And so I think for the near future anyway, that's what that party is going to look like. And, you know, maybe if they lose again, there will be a new movement of people who say, no, we have to alter things, and maybe they'll be persuasive. But for now, they're still traveling down this road that Trump charted for them.
Seamus, we got an interesting call, and I wish Matt from Albert Lea could have hung on, but I think he couldn't. He said, we, in our conversation, keep going back to this election thing. Matt says, I'm not protesting or running on the Capitol, but I'm a conservative, and I definitely felt like there were some aspects of the election results that were never explained. I'm still skeptical, and it feels like people on the left are just like, it's fine. So I get why there's frustration. So he sounds to me like an important constituency here, Seamus. He's not going to do what happened on January 6th, but he and is clearly listening to public radio, but he still feels like he has not had a full explanation of some of the concerns that are raised by Republicans and former President Trump. What do you do about someone like that?
I mean, this is where it comes down to like individual conversations, right? In many ways, January 6th provided an opportunity to determine where someone would fall on that, right? Either you double down and say, you know, that violence was acceptable in that, we needed to do that, or you say, that doesn't sound right to me, let me look at the other facts. And you're hoping that a moment like that kind of jars the system. You know, I think back to like the QAnon movement. You know, they saw January 6th as their moment, and then it didn't happen. So you had an opportunity right there to try to pull those folks back from the brink. Unfortunately, there wasn't government programs, NGOs, civil society who could work with those individuals to get them off. And then the QAnon movement basically moved the goalpost after that. So we have these moments where we can affect people, and they can look at the facts and say, okay, you know what, that makes sense to me, or that doesn't make sense, or I need more information. But those mm-hmm. are a lot of these kind of dinner side chats around the kitchen table that unfortunately we don't necessarily have anymore because we sit in our own little silos and don't really talk to anyone else.
It's been a really interesting conversation with you both. Thank you very much. Seamus Hughes is Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. Paul Waldman is an opinion columnist for the Plumline blog at The Washington Post and senior writer at The American Prospect. What we're talking about Monday morning at 9 a.m. has a lot to connect with our conversation today. Many, many millions of Americans have gotten at least one dose of the vaccine, but many of the people who haven't and are succumbing to this Delta variant are people who believe in the myths and the misinformation about the virus and the vaccine. So Monday, we're going to talk about how to put facts up against those myths and that misinformation, why it's so important. And if you are in one of those kind of dinner table conversations that Seamus was just talking about with someone who is hesitating about the vaccine, resisting the facts about the vaccine, our guest will arm you with some facts and maybe some persuasive arguments to help out with that. So we talk about that Monday at 9.
Support for programming comes from St. John's Abbey, offering a rare opportunity to enjoy a self-guided tour of the Abbey Gardens this Friday and Saturday. Details on scheduling your visit are online at stjohnsabbey.org.
NPR News with Carrie Miller is produced by Kelly Gordon and Ariana Rosas. You can hear the show live at 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News or by subscribing to the NPR News with Carrie Miller podcast. Thanks for listening.